You are now listening to Justice Lit on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the unceded territories of the Musqueam people at the University of British Columbia. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Justice Lit. We are up and going with another episode of the Shakespeare Sonnet series. We have already finished half of 100, and so today I'll be starting off with Sonnet 53. You know, at the start of this series, when I was planning it, I was a bit skeptical on how long and kind of worried about how long the series might take. And surprisingly, it's not taking as long as I expected. And I'm also getting a lot of positive feedback from you guys about this series. And so I'm super happy and I am super glad that everyone is liking it so far, and that also it's not taking as long as a time than I thought. And so Sonnet 53 is going to be our starting poem for today. But before that, I have, of course, some ad show promos and PSAs to go over, and our first song of the day called Falling from Christina Sheldon, a local Vancouver artist. And so after those, we'll be right back. And then Sonnet 53 is going to be read. And so we'll be back after that.
Every other Wednesday from 6:30 to 8 p.m. for Sam Squanch's Hideaway with your host, Anita B., as she plays all Canadian music with a focus on indie rock and pop.
DOXA, Western Canada's largest documentary film festival, returns to present the 24th edition from May 1st to the 11th. DOXA will screen a roster of timely and thought-provoking documentaries in theatrical venues across the city, bringing filmmakers and audiences together for an engaging cinema experience. The 2025 lineup showcases 39 features, 30 short and mid-length films, and industry events. Screenings will take place at the Vancouver Playhouse, the Cinematheque, VIF Center, and SFU Goldcore Center for the Arts. Head to doxa.ca to grab your tickets and explore all that DOXA has to offer this May. Western Canadian Music Award winners Sargent and Comrade are back with their signature blend of lo-fi soul and ninja funk. Their upcoming album Power draws inspiration from the art of kung fu, with themes of inner harmony, discipline, and self-love. Catch Sargent and Comrade in concert, presented by Infidels Jazz at the Kingsway Club in Vancouver on Saturday, May 3rd.
Are you interested in radio? Do you want to start your own show but you don't know where to get started? Make your radio dreams come true by joining a collective. From the news collective, the arts collective, the music collective, the sports collective, the accessibility collective, the indigenous collective, and the intersectionality collective, there's something for everyone. And we provide free technical training to get started. Explore these worlds virtually and in person, and be prepared to make fun friends. For more information, visit citr.ca/get involved.
Tune in every Thursday from 11 p.m. till midnight for Copy and Paste with your host, Tim, a.k.a. Autonomy, the very best in underground dance music.
Like nothing can fill my heart. can come alive. I feel like I'm falling. I'm screaming, I'm begging, I'm calling. I need a friend more.
That was Christina Sheldon's Falling. We'll get right into Sonnet 53. What is your substance, whereof are you made, that millions of strange shadows on you tend? Since everyone hath, everyone, one shade, and you but one can every shadow lend. Describe Adonis and the counterfeit, is poorly imitated after you. On Helen's cheek all art of beauty set, and you and Gretchen tires are painted new. Speak of the spring and foison of the year, the one doth shadow of your beauty show, the other as your bounty doth appear, and you in every blessed shape we know. In all external grace you have some part, but you like none, none you for constant heart. Now this poem seems to be using a lot of the language from Neoplatonism, and through this the poet praises the beloved both as the essence of beauty, the very idea of it, which is only imperfectly reflected in lesser beauties, and as the epitome of constancy. When we look at lines 1 and 2, here the speaker marvels at the beloved's almost supernatural essence. And the word substance suggests a deep essential being, not just outward appearance. However, though, paradoxically, the beloved produces, quote-unquote, millions of strange shadows or reflections and echoes of themselves. And it's as if countless things in the world imitate or derive from the beloved, and that ultimately suggests that their beauty or spirit is so immense it manifests everywhere. And so with this, we could see that there is a tension here between the notion of uniqueness and multiplicity. Moving on to lines 3 and 4, normally a person would cast only one shade, which means both a literal shadow and a metaphorical image, or what we call aura. But here, the beloved is so uniquely powerful that despite having just one being, they can create or inspire every possible form, or what it's implied here as a shadow. And so this almost, in a sense, elevates the beloved to a godlike status, one figure whose influence multiplies infinitely. And so that's significant through the lines 3 and 4. Lines 5 and 6, here we see Adonis, the epitome of male beauty in mythology. Speaking of Adonis, I believe I wrote a paper about the Garden of Adonis. But actually, it might not be it, or it could be. Let me check right now. And I talked about the constant metamorphosis the metamorphosization, I don't know if that's a word, but the constant metamorphosization of the character of Adonis. Now, that just kind of brought to mind because Adonis is brought up here, but it was about Venus and Adonis, I think. Yes, from the Fairy Queen, from Edmund Spenser. But here we are given the Adonis here again, which is the epitome of male beauty in mythology, and how Adonis is quote-unquote poorly imitated compared to the beloved. And so even the most celebrated figures of beauty are lesser copies, and what the poem says, counterfeits, next to them. And the word counterfeit here emphasizes both imitation and a sense of falseness. Lines 7 and 8. So we are now presented with Helen of Troy, whose beauty caused the Trojan War, is here used to represent the pinnacle of the feminine beauty. And so the phrase Grecian tires means Greek attire or fashion, and even when art adorns Helen or paints the ideals of classicism, it is only capturing fragments of the beloved's newer and truer form. And so through this, we can, in a sense, conclude that art can only approximate the beloved, even when it's trying its best through the historic ideals that were given or present. Lines 9 to 10, spring is relevant here, the season of renewal and lush abundance, which is seen through the phrase foison, which means harvest or plenty, and how that is only a shadow of the beloved's beauty. And through the lines 9 and 10, we could see that nature itself is diminished by comparison, and it reflects only a pale image of their loveliness. Lines 11 to 12, the bounty, which is the richness and generosity of the harvest, is resembling the beloved's own spiritual or moral generosity. Again, the phrase bounty emphasizes that. And so through this, the beloved's image seems to live in, quote-unquote, every blessed shape. And that means that they are reflected in every beautiful or good thing that exists. The final couplet. So in every outer form of beauty, hence the external grace, the beloved has some part. The phrase some part is significant because it emphasizes that it emphasizes a share or echo, and how a share or echo is present in every lovely, in everything lovely. But, however, we see that the beloved is unlike any other, in the phrase you like none, and no one else is like them in the phrase none you, especially in possessing a quote-unquote constant heart, which is seen to be a faithful, steadfast inner nature. And so this last idea is significant, I think, throughout this whole poem, where it emphasizes or explains that external beauty is everywhere, but the true uniqueness of the beloved lies not just in appearance, but in inner virtue. In other words, emotional constancy. And so that was Sonnet 53. Moving on to Sonnet 54. Oh, how much more doth beauty beauteous seem by that sweet ornament which truth doth give. The rose looks fair, but fairer we it deem for that sweet odor which doth in it live. The canker blooms have full as deep a dye as the perfumed tincture of the roses hang on such thorns and play as wantonly when summer's breath their masked buds discloses, but for their virtue only is their show. They live unwooed and unrespected fade. Die to themselves, sweet roses do not sow. of their sweet deaths are sweetest odors made, and so of you, beauteous and lovely youth, when that shell vade by birth distills your truth. Now here, the beloved's truth is compared to the fragrance in the rose. And as that fragrance is distilled into perfume, so the beloved's truth distills in verse. And so lines 1 and 2, we could see that beauty looks even more beautiful when it is combined with truth, with authenticity, with virtue, or with inner goodness. And so technically, in technical terms, there's a layered repetition here with the phrase beauty, beauteous. And this intensifies the idea of the external attractiveness alone not being complete. And it becomes more radiant when paired with the inner integrity with the phrase truth. And we see an admiring reflective tone here. Lines 3 and 4. So here, the rose is already visually beautiful, but we value it more because of its fragrance, something deeper than appearance. And the rose here becomes a symbol of external beauty enhanced by an inward quality. And if you notice the phrase "in it live," it in a sense suggests the inner scent and how the inner scent is vital, how it's alive, how it's intrinsic, not just superficial. Lines 5 and 8. The canker blooms, which means wild and less valued, so less valued flowers. How that can look just as richly colored as roses. And they grow on the same kind of thorny stems and also open their buds just as freely when summer comes. And so, technique-wise, we see that Shakespeare here uses a parallel structure where the canker blooms and roses are visually similar. And the wantonly implies a kind of wild, uncontrolled display. And through these two lines, we see that appearance alone cannot distinguish true value, and deeper qualities are necessary. Lines 9 to 12, again, we are here with the canker blooms, and we see that the canker blooms have no virtue beyond their appearance because they lack the inner worth, the sweet scent, I should say, and they die unnoticed and unloved. And through this, we see a contrast, roses, and how the roses, although they die, release an even sweeter scent. And so their death produces something valuable and lasting, unlike the canker blooms. And so we see a moral or philosophical underpinning here in these four lines, where true beauty or true virtue outlasts physical life. And so the phrase "die to themselves" suggests a sad, self-contained ending for the canker blooms, whereas the roses contribute something enduring to the world. The final couplet, here we see that the speaker turns directly to a quote-unquote beauteous and lovely youth, likely the fair youth Shakespeare addresses in many of his sonnets. And also says that when your physical beauty fades, here in the phrase vade, which is meaning fade, your truth or your essence and your inner worth will be preserved through the poetry. In the phrase, by verse distills your truth. And so distills here is, I think, a brilliant metaphor. And just as how rose oil is distilled from roses, so does the youth's essence, and how that essence is extracted and preserved through the poetry. And so that was Sonnet 54. We'll move on to Sonnet 55. Not marble nor the gilded monuments of princess shall outlive this powerful rhythm, but you shall shine more bright in these contents than unswept stone besmeared with sluttish time, when wasteful war shall statues overturn and broils root out the work of masonry, nor Mars his sword nor war's quick fire shall burn the living record of your memory. Gainst death and all oblivious enmity shall you pace forth, your praise shall still find room even in the eyes of all posterity that wear this world out to the ending doom. So till the judgment that yourself arise, you live in this and dwell in lover's eyes. Now, continuing the idea of the beloved's distillation into poetry, specifically in the couplet of the sonnet before, 54, the poet here now claims that his verse will be a quote-unquote living record in which the beloved will quote-unquote shine bright until doomsday. And so in the first quatrain, specifically the phrase, not marble nor the gilded monuments, and so on. This immediately sets up a comparison between physical monuments, like statues or tombs, built for princes, and also poetry in the phrase, this powerful rhyme. And so we see that Shakespeare here boldly claims that poetry is more endearing than even the grandest stone structures. And we can also notice, or I think it's also worthwhile noticing, the confident tone where the poem asserts its own power in the phrase gilded monuments, and how not gilded monuments, but just in the overall vibe of the poem. And gilded monuments, the phrase, evokes wealth and grandeur. And also, not just that, but something fragile or corruptible. And so that kind of gives us an idea of how gold can tarnish as well. And in line 4, the phrase, unswept stone besmeared with sluttish time. Now this phrase, unswept stone, suggests neglect. And so statues once honored are now dirty and forgotten. And the sluttish time personifies time as a careless, degrading force. And so we see that Shakespeare uses these imagery and images to show how even the grandest physical legacies decay, while poetry, specifically this poem, will keep the subject alive. The second quatrain, we see that in the phrase, when wasteful war shall statues overturn, and so on, it continues the idea, but intensifies it. And so war, which is seen as wasteful and broils, Mars' sword, war's quick fire. So that is shown through war, and that war is shown as even more destructive than time. But however, despite this, the quote-unquote living record, which is seen as the poem itself, will survive. And so the phrase living record is significant as it imagines writing as a organic, vivid, and not just words on a page. And so we see that memory through poetry ultimately becomes a living thing. The third quatrain celebrates the poem's victory over death and oblivion. We can see that through the phrase oblivious enmity, which is equivalent to forgetfulness as an active enemy. And the phrase pace forth suggests a proud, almost royal movement through time. And the subject's quote-unquote praise shall still find room even as time collapses. And so we can see that this kind of translates into the phrase, wear this world out to the ending doom, which is a grand apocalyptic image of endurance. And so through the couplet, the final couplet, it offers a kind of theological framing, in a sense, where until Judgment Day, when the beloved will literally rise again, they will live through this poem and dwell in lovers' eyes, meaning that future generations of readers and lovers will find inspiration in the beloved's memory, kept alive by the poetry. And so that was Sonnet 55. Now, before we move on to Sonnet 56, I have one more song for you guys to play, and it is called Danny, a Portrait by Sylvie McCormack, and so we'll be right back after this.
Our only goal will be this western shore.
They used to call me Mick Jagger in Kelowna. They called me Robert Plant in Western Shore.
Raise every morning.
Valhalla, I am coming.
That was Danny, a Portrait by Sylvie McCormack. Sonnet 56. Sweet love, renew thy force, be it not said, thy edge should blunter be than appetite, which but today by feeding is allayed, tomorrow sharpened in his former might. So love be thou, although today thou fill thy hungry eyes even till they wink with fullness. Tomorrow see again, and do not kill the spirit of love with a perpetual dullness. Let this sad interim like the ocean be, which parts the shore where two contracted new, come daily to the banks that when they see returned of love more blessed than may be the view. Or call it winter, which being full of care makes summer's welcome thrice more wished more rare. Now here we see that the poet addresses the spirit of love, and then the beloved, urging that love be reinvigorated and that the present separation of the lovers serve to renew their love's intensity. Lines 1 and 2. Here, the speaker addresses the sweet love directly, pleading for it to renew its strength. And so we see that love is imagined almost as a weapon, and how it has an edge that can become blunt if not sharpened. But interestingly, the appetite, desire for food, is the standard here, where the speaker says that love should not be weaker than bodily hunger, implying that emotional or romantic longing should be even stronger and more enduring than the physical appetite. Lines 3 and 4, the speaker here extends the metaphor of appetite, and so even after satisfying hunger today by feeding, appetite naturally will return stronger the next day. And so thus, love, too, should not be satisfied once and for all, but it should continuously renew itself. And so its desire also being reborn daily. And so we get a bit of a comparing with the appetite and love. And so we're comparing the processes here. Lines 5 and 6, again, we are presented with the appetite. And so urging love to imitate natural appetite, we see that the speaker says that even if today love feels full, and so the eyes as symbols of longing are stuffed until they wink. So even if that is all full, tomorrow that hunger should return fresh. And through lines 7 and 8, the repetition of tomorrow stresses continuity. And so love must reawaken every day. And if not, it risks killing its own spirit by becoming dull or stagnant and lifeless. And so we are emphasized, or we are urged to consider or know that perpetual dullness is death to passion. Lines 9 to 12, we are presented with a beautiful image, love being compared to an ocean that separates two lovers, in the phrase contracted new, and how that suggests newly joined, possibly even newly married. And so even though the ocean parts them temporarily, coming back to the shore to see one another makes their reunion more blessed. And so we see that separation, rather than harming love, intensifies it and makes reunion sweeter. The final couplet, we see that the speaker offers another metaphor and says that separation is like winter, which is hard and quote-unquote full of care, of suffering, cold, and waiting. And yet, because winter is hard, summer is appreciated even more, in the phrase thrice more wished, and the absence strengthens love just as hardship deepens joy. And so again, one of my biggest reasons on why I love Shakespeare is that a lot of his poems, most of it, is very relevant to this day as well. And so with Sonnet 56, I get a sense of marriage advice, in a sense, and just in general relationship advice, where the love should be constantly given the effort to preserve and increase and to flourish, and how a lot of people nowadays, which is totally humanly natural, I think, but just kind of get used to it and they take love for granted, and how Shakespeare brilliantly gives us the metaphor of appetite, or the comparison of appetite, and how the appetite, even though you're full, will never stay full. And so he's saying how love should never stay full, but always be refreshed and sought for and constantly worked for, even though it may be full at the moment. And so it's just brilliant. Sonnet 56, brilliant. And all the other ones, of course. Sonnet 57. Being your slave, what should I do but tend upon the hours and times of your desire? I have no precious time at all to spend, nor services to do till you require. Nor dare I chide the world without end hour, whilst I, my sovereign, watch the clock for you. Nor think the bitterness of absence sour, when you have bid your servant once adieu. Nor dare I question with my jealous thought, where you may be or your affairs suppose, but like a sad slave, stay and think of naught, save where you are happy, or where you are how happy you make those. So true a fool is love, that in your will, through you do anything, he thinks no ill. Here the poet presents his relationship with the beloved as that of servant and master. And as the beloved servant, the poet describes himself with barely suppressed bitterness, as having no life or wishes of his own, as he waits like a sad slave for the commands of his sovereign. And so the first two lines, we immediately are presented with the speaker casting themselves as a slave, which means total submission. And the phrase tend suggests a careful, attentive service, almost like a servant in waiting. Moving on to lines 3 and 4. Here the speaker denies themselves agency. And their time only becomes precious when the beloved demands it. And the phrase, nor services to do, deepens the sense of uselessness. And so, until they are called upon, the speaker has no purpose. Lines 5 and 6, the phrase, world without end hour, in a sense, exaggerates how long and endless time feels during absence. The phrase, my sovereign, will continue the hierarchical imagery, where the love, or the beloved, is like a king or queen, and the speaker is obedient and almost worshipful. Lines 7 and 8, despite the bitterness of separation, the speaker refuses to feel resentful. And the phrase, bid your servant once adieu, will highlight how effortless it is for the beloved to leave, while the servant, the speaker in this sense, is left behind in pain. With lines 9 and 10, the speaker admits to jealousy, but immediately suppresses it. And they do not dare to even imagine what the beloved is doing. And it's a painful self-imposed blindness to maintain loyalty. Lines 11 to 12. Again, we see the imagery of slavery, not just serving, but sad and full of sorrow. And the speaker imagines the beloved making others happy. And that suggests that the beloved might be with others. And the speaker chooses not to feel bitterness, only to think lovingly about their happiness. And the closing couplet, we are concluding that love is foolish and so fateful that it justifies anything that the beloved does. And the phrase, in your will, implies the beloved's freedom to act however they like, yet love still sees no fault. So moving on to Sonnet 58. That God forbid that made me first your slave, I should in thought control your times of pleasure, or at your hand the account of hours to crave, being your vassal bound to stay your leisure. Oh, let me suffer being at your beck, the imprisoned absence of your liberty, and patience tame to sufferance bide each check, without accusing you of injury. Be where you list your charter is so strong that you yourself may privilege your time to what you will, to you it doth belong. Yourself to pardon of self-doing crime, I am to wait, though waiting so be hell, not blame your pleasure, be it ill or well. Now here the sonnet repeats the idea and some of the language of Sonnet 57, though the pain of waiting upon and waiting for the beloved and asking nothing in return seems more intense in the present poem. And so here the first quatrain, lines 1 and 4, that the phrase, "that God forbid," we see that the speaker immediately invokes divine authority, implying that it would be almost sacrilegious for him to try to control the beloved. And the phrase, "that made me first your slave," this relationship seems unequal, and that love has enslaved the speaker to be the beloved. The phrase, "control your times of pleasure, account of hours," he feels that he has no right to question or keep track of how the beloved spends their time, even if it pains him. And the word vassal, so we see that a vassal owes fealty to a lord, again emphasizing the power imbalance. And so he must stay your leisure, which means wait until the beloved is ready to see him. The second quatrain of lines 5 and 8. The phrase, "suffer being at your back," is significant as he accepts suffering and the need to wait at the beloved's command. And we are also presented with a paradox in the phrase, "the imprisoned absence of your liberty." And so the beloved's liberty imprisons the speaker. The phrase, "patience tame to sufferance," the speaker's patience has been domesticated, subdued into quiet endurance. But even though he suffers, he refuses to blame the beloved, and this is seen in the phrase, "without accusing you of injury." The third quatrain, the phrase, "be where you list," is important, as the beloved has the freedom to go wherever and do whatever they want, and privilege your time to what you will. That phrase is that they own their time completely. And the final couplet, the speaker ultimately ends by accepting total emotional suffering as the price of devotion. Moving on to Sonnet 59. "If there be nothing new but that which is, hath been before, how are our brains begilled, which, laboring for invention, bear amiss the second burden of a former child? Oh, that record could, with the backward look, even a 500 courses of the sun, show me your image in some antique book, since mind at first in character was done, that I might see what the old world could say to this composed wonder of your frame, whether we are mended, or whether better they, or whether revolution be the same. Oh, sure I am the wits of former days, to subjects worse have given admiring praise." Now we're presented here with a poem that plays with the idea of history as cyclical, and with the proverb, "there is nothing new under the sun." If he could go back in time, he writes, he could see how the beloved's beauty was praised in the distant past, and thus judged whether the world has progressed, regressed, or stayed the same. And so the lines 1 to 4, we are opened with a philosophical premise, that if everything that exists is merely a repetition of what has already existed, then the human desire for invention or originality is misguided or beguiled. And the phrase "bear amiss" suggests that our attempts at creating something new are doomed to miss the mark, and we are simply repeating old creations, meaning a second-generation version of something first born long ago. And that phrase, "the second burden of a former child," kind of illuminates on that. Lines 5 and 8. "So he wishes that he could look back through record, which is seen as historical documents or literature, etc., across 500 years, in the phrase 500 courses of the sun, to see if the beloved's image had been captured in some ancient writing. And since mind at first in character was done, that phrase in a sense means that since human thought was first recorded in writing, all this has come to be. And so the character, the phrase character, could be seen as writing or lettering. And so through this, we see that he fantasizes about discovering a description of his beloved from ancient times, suggesting the beloved's beauty or essence is so timeless, it must have existed before. Lines 9 to 12, we see that through these lines that he wants to know how the old world would respond to the beloved's perfectly composed form. And that phrase is seen in composed wonder of your frame. And we also, we're also given a question. And, or the questioning of progress, I should say. And that is, are we, in the phrase, are we mended? So are we improved now compared to the past? Were they better, or is human nature just cyclical? In the phrase, revolution be the same. And so again, I will say that this is relevant to this day and of age right now. And we are, to interpret this, we see that Shakespeare reflects on the historical change, and how do people or do human beings really improve over time, or are we just simply repeating ourselves endlessly? And the last couplet, we are closing with confidence, where even if everything repeats, he is sure that past writers have praised subjects less worthy than his beloved. And the beloved exceeds anything that has come before, and he is more beautiful, more admirable than the subjects earlier poets praised. So we're ending off with a bit of confidence here. And we have come to the end of the show today. We went over Sonnet 53 to 59 pretty intensively. And so I'm happy we got through this much. My next episode, or next live episode, will be on the Monday of the 29th at 12 p.m. And so if you guys are able to join, please do and tune in for more Shakespeare. We'll be continuing off from here. So next episode, we'll be looking at Sonnet 60. It is a beautiful day, beautiful evening here in Vancouver, BC. And so I hope everyone enjoys the lovely weather. The lovely sunshine. The sun is setting a bit late now, since summer is coming up soon around the corner. And so just take all the advantages you guys can get, because I do know that the rain will start to kind of cripple in sometime this week. And so have yourselves a wonderful rest of the week and day, and I will see you guys again in my next episode. Thank you all for tuning in. I will see you guys again next time. Thank you all. Bye-bye. Narrative to underscore. He made a way of staying safe, a play on staying negligent for sport.